Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of Captain Hunter's Podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in. I truly appreciate your time, your energy, your effort, and what you're doing to make this podcast successful. I truly appreciate it. Thank you so much. So I really wanted to dive in today and get into our topic. Today's topic is the militarization of police. That is our topic for today. Now, why would a former police officer, a former police captain who enjoyed all the bells and whistles and all the toys that officers often get, why would he do an episode or talk about police militarization? Well, if you've been following this podcast for some time now, then you will understand that I'm actually dedicated to police reform, police and the communities in which they serve, having a better relationship and towards that goal. That is the reason that I'm doing a podcast about this. I enjoyed the bells and whistles. I enjoyed the toys. I enjoyed all that kind of stuff. But there comes a point and a place where we have to say enough is enough. Too much of any one good thing becomes a negative. Now, what are we talking about when we talk about this? Just as layman's terms, just you and I talking or just having a discussion and conversation, I would say that the overabundance of military gear, which is being forwarded down from the government towards the police. What does it look like? Well, it looks like all the hand grenades. It looks like the armored Humvees, the blacked out uniforms, the Kevlar helmets, all the things that you would see basically on a field of battle in Iraq or in any other theater of war, you see now in the streets of America for less than necessary purposes. Now, once again, this is just you and I talking. We'll get into some academic literature and statistics, news reports, articles, and things like that in a little bit. But let's just have a conversation about what we're talking about so we can understand where we're going with this. I'm not talking about police officers staying safe when they are in emergency type situations. I'm talking about mission creep is gone off the rails. It's too much, too far, and we have to rein it in and pull it back. Let's start with it at the beginning. When SWAT was originally created in the 1970s in LA, it was created as a method and means of officers to stay safe in order to deal with emergency type situations and those that, which were unusual. SWAT stands for Special Weapons and Tactics. So they were going into barricaded suspects in which they knew the suspects to be armed. Any type of emergency type of situation, this is where they were going into. And so we see now a mission creep away from all that kind of stuff, where in the 1970s, they started off with a mission that was about emergency type situations, one that ordinary, routine, regular officers, a bank robbery that has gone bad, in which, remember, back in the 1990s, there was that famous bank robbery where the people were wearing all kind of Kevlar, officers' guns had no effect. That's a situation in which the SWAT teams would be called out. That's what we're talking about. And so now we get on this mission creep. This is what's going on in the original establishment in the 1970s. We have a mission creep going into the 1980s and 90s, in which this war on drugs is ramping up. And coupled with that, we have a bloated military in which they have too much wares, too much hardware, too much of everything. If they're not selling it to other countries, then that extra overflow is then transferred down to police agencies. So that's the basic history of it. The basic history of SWAT teams originating in the 1970s for completely legitimate purposes. And I have no issues or problems with and when an emergency situation arises that specialty teams are called in order to deal with those type of problems. When we have a barricaded suspect, we call in the specialists, right? We had hostage negotiations teams, HNT teams, hostage negotiation teams, in which we called them in and we said, hey, listen, this is a problem. This is the person on the other side of the door in the home or in the building, whatever. And they're refusing to come out. See what if you can use your verbal judo in order to make this resolution come out peacefully. No problems or issues with that. No problems or issues with SWAT teams who are faced with serious emergency existent type circumstances in which something has to be done quick, fast, and in a hurry, and we want it done efficiently and we want it done safely. And so these type of officers take it upon themselves to train more to deal with what they got to deal with. No problems, no issues that I have as a supervisor and now as a citizen. So let's just talk a little bit about the mission creep. Why did this happen? Why is it now that the military has been handing down these weapons of war, military grade armor carriers, weapons, rifles, hand grenades, grenade launchers, and all this kind of stuff? Why is this going on? So let's explore this for a minute. So this is from an article in Newsweek.com. It's fairly dated. It was written in 2014. Faced with a bloated military and what is perceived as a worsening drug crisis, the 101st Congress in 1990 enacted the National Defense Authorization Act. Section 1208 of the NDAA, that's the National Defense Authorization Act, allowed Secretary of Defense to transfer federal and state agencies' personal property of the Department of Defense, Is that really personal property? Including small arms and ammunition. That the secretary determines A, is suitable for such use by agencies in counter-drug activities, and B, access to the needs of the Department of Defense. It was called the 1208 program. In 1996, Congress replaced Section 1208 with Section 1033. So if you ever heard the 1033, then that's where it comes from. It originally started as 1208, and then it was changed to 1033. So there's two parameters that they gave, right? It has to be anything that is suitable for agencies to do counter-drug activities, and B, it has to be excess to the needs of the Department of Defense. So anything that they had extra and that the local police agencies could use as far as drug suppression, then that is why these agencies got this particular type of, and styles of weapon. The idea was that if the U.S. wanted its police to act like drug warriors, it should equip them like drug warriors, which it has, to the tune of around $4.3 billion in equipment. Now, this article was written in 2014. That number is well over $6 billion in equipment. $6 billion of your tax money that you have paid for to go to the military to fight these wars overseas. They've had excess. $6 billion since the 1990s has been excess, according to the report by the American Civil Liberties Union. By providing law enforcement agencies with surplus military equipment free of charge, the NDAA encourages police to employ military weapons and military tactics, right? So this is the theory that you get, that if you have something, you're going to use it. You get all these special weapons and trainings and tactics and armaments and things like that, then you're going to use them. You're going to look for excuse to use them. And this is exactly what's going on. 1033 procurements are not matters of public record, and the Defense Logistics Agency, DLA, which coordinates distribution of military surplus, refuses to reveal the names of agencies requesting tactical items like assault rifles and MRAPs for security reasons. Police in Watertown, Connecticut, with a population of 22,000, recently required a mine-resistant ambush protection vehicle. That's what MRAP stands for, a mine-resistant ambush protected vehicle, designed to protect soldiers from roadside bombs, for $2,800. The original sticker price was $733,000. So Watertown, Connecticut paid $2,800 for that. So this is a little bit deceiving, because Watertown, Connecticut, now I know this because I live in Connecticut, Watertown, Connecticut, they're a part of a regional team consisting of my former agency, Waterbury, and a few other towns. So that one Bearcat that they got is actually for use for the entire team consisting of different municipalities. And police in Bloomington, Georgia, population of 2,700, acquired four grenade launchers through the program. Four grenade launchers. Ridiculous. So let's talk a little bit about why there's such a negative pushback amongst this. One of the reasons for a pushback is an episode that I plan to release called Asset Forfeiture. So I'm going to talk about that in a future episode. What I'm going to exactly going to title, I don't know, but I'm going to definitely going to talk about asset forfeiture. This idea of the police officers using and buying and equipping themselves with armaments by asset forfeiture and then buying more armaments is something that continues to go on. Here's from Reason.com. Iowa cops buy an armored vehicle with $300,000 in asset forfeiture funds. So think about this. One problem that's already a sticky situation is asset forfeitures. That is when police officers through the state are seizing drugs, seizing money, particularly money in cars and whatever, and either selling it, particularly houses and cars, or selling it, getting the money and reaping the benefits. So that's already one thing that is already on the radar of those who want police reform, this idea of asset forfeiture, particularly civil asset forfeiture. I'll discuss that at a later time. So they take one problem of asset forfeiture, in which they've gathered $300,000, and then they buy something that is going to further their distrust amongst the community and buy an armored vehicle. This is one of the reasons for the pushback. Previously mentioned, it's already tied to the military industrial complex. Why is there pushback? Well, there's pushback for a number of reasons. First reason is it causes great harm to police reputation. There's an article that was written by Jonathan Momolo. I hope I'm saying his name right. M-U-M-M-O-L-O, Momolo. He wrote an article for the Princeton University. The title of the article is Militarization Fails to Enhance Police Safety or Reduce Crime, but May Harm Police Reputation. So this is the essence of the report that he wrote, is that militarization of the police, it fails to enhance police safety. It was just written last year, March of 2018. So it's a fairly recent report. It's particularly concerning the academic world. So his argument is that it fails to enhance police safety. The mission creep that I talked about before is that officers initially started off doing emergency type situations, right? Then we got the Congress in the 1990s who said, okay, if we got excess weapons, and if the police departments throughout the country can use these weapons to do drug enforcement activities, then we will give them the weapons of war. The reason the purpose is that because they wanted to make sure that when officers are doing drug raids, they're not getting injured and or shot. But when you go through Momolo's report, he details and documents very carefully that there is not as much danger to the officers. So just to read a little bit from this particular report. And before I get to the report, let me just talk to you about what happened in the state of Maryland and why this has become such a big deal in the state of Maryland. The common people understand that there has been numerous practices and policies of the police that have been very hurtful to especially black and brown communities and as well as poor communities. But when you're a member of the higher echelon, then you don't seem to care about what's going on. So one day, the higher echelon got to feel the full force and brunt of what the common people were talking about. In 2008, police in Prince George's County, Maryland, conducted a violent drug raid on the home of Berwyn Heights Mayor Chaya Calvo. They didn't find any drugs, but they shot and killed Calvo's two Labrador retrievers and held him and his mother-in-law at gunpoint for hours. Calvo has since become an outspoken advocate of SWAT reform. His efforts persuaded the Maryland legislature to pass the county's first law requiring all of the state's police departments to issue a biannual report on how often and for what purpose they use SWAT teams. Calvo's, remember, this guy is a mayor or former mayor, three recommendations for SWAT reform. First, think first. SWAT should be deployed only in emergencies or after a thorough investigation and when a suspect poses a specific risk to the safety of others. It should not be routine. Teach judgment. Written policies and protocols are critical, but officers must understand why and not just what. Training should emphasize sound judgment and restraint. Experience matters, and there is no place in police work for an MP5 submachine gun. Civilian oversight. Law enforcement can't police itself. Public reporting and independent oversight with investigatory powers to uncover problems and connect the dots will help check over deployment and abuse. Because of what happened to this mayor, this is his three recommendations. One, think first. Two, think, teach judgment. And three, civilian oversight. So once again, if this didn't happen to this particular mayor, we might not have gotten there. I just read for you Reason.com, and that was released in 2011. Again, pretty dated. So let's go back to Momolo's report. Militarization fails to enhance public police safety or reduce crime, but may harm reputation. The rare census of SWAT activity available in Maryland, and remember 2008, what happened in Maryland, and because of this persuasion of the mayor, they changed everything and they started to do some reporting and started gathering some data. So this is where this comes from. The rare census of SWAT activity available in Maryland offers a valuable opportunity to study the stated reasons for and geographic correlates of military policing. Maryland also exhibits large variation in the racial components of locality. Roughly 90% of SWAT deployments in that state over 5 years were conducted to serve search warrants. I hope you guys are seeing the picture here. We went from emergency situations to now 90% of SWAT deployments are drug raids and drug search warrants. Previous work has shown that SWAT teams serve three warrants, a practice which escalated as a result of the war on drugs. Is an extreme disruptive event in the lives of citizens and often involves percussive grenades, battering rams, substantial property damage, and in rare cases, deadly altercations stemming from citizens' mistaken belief that they are experiencing a home invasion. Less than 5% of deployments involved a barricaded scenario, which typically involves an armed suspect refusing to surrender to police. Less than 5%. Violence to people and animals is rare, and gunshots are fired 1.2% of the time, roughly 100 deployments during this period. There you have his particular data on the effectiveness of it and what the deployments are for. 90% of them in a five-year period in the state of Maryland, we know, are geared towards drug raids. Shots are fired 1.2% of the time, but when they do happen, they often kill dogs, and people are often fighting it back because they think that their home is being invaded. What this study determined was that as far as police perception and acceptability of this, it has a negative effect upon that. Officer safety, as I mentioned, is also not a factor. It does not enhance officer safety. It does not reduce crime, and it has a negative effect on police perception and what people think about police. So take a look at that report. It's all in there. Here's another article from Charles Koch 1033institute.org. Over 8,000 law enforcement agencies have utilized the 1033 program to access more than $6 billion worth of military equipment, such as night vision goggles, machine guns, armor vehicles, bayonets. What the heck do they need bayonets for? Grenade launchers. What do they need grenade launchers for? And military aircraft. Other items can be accessed by local law enforcement agencies through the program include field packets, canteens, sleeping bags, and ponchos. I mean, it's funny, except for it's not funny. It's funny, except for the fact that it's not funny. And certainly when somebody throws a grenade through your home, you certainly will not be laughing. The increased use of military equipment has coincided with an increased use of military tactics such as SWAT teams and no-knock raids by law enforcement agencies. In recent years, police departments from Ferguson, Charlotte, and Southampton have received criticism for the use of military tactics. One study found that the use of paramilitary-style teams by law enforcement increased more than 1,400% since 1980. I have a great pleasure in speaking with the former chief, David Cooper, who has a blog called Improving Police. It's on WordPress, improvingpolice.wordpress.com. Once again, the name of his blog is Improving Police, and he did an article called Why Militarizing Police is a Very Bad Idea. He lists some stats, and I'll just read these. These are the key findings. Over 90% of citizens in the United States have at least one SWAT team present in their county of residence. 91% of SWAT call-ups are not for armed, barricaded persons, but in non-emergency warrant services, which often result in property being seized and damage to the property, i.e. door breaches. Cities instituting SWAT teams do not experience a reduction in crime or reduction in officer injuries, the primary reasons for their organization. The higher percentage of African Americans in any given area, the more SWAT team deployments in those areas. 84% of the time property is seized, and 70% of the events are forcible entries. Less than 1% of the time are shots fired or persons killed by SWAT teams. The result of this is a negative impact on trust and support of the police, which is necessary for police effectiveness. I will be interviewing David Cooper, Chief David Cooper, on another episode, so stay tuned for that. But I thought his blog was very much on point with everything that I have been reading and stating about this particular topic for some time now. I got to read to you a little bit about this from another article from Princeton.edu, again, about Momolo. I read from his report before. Momolo also wanted to test whether militarized tactics occur more frequently in communities of color. To do this, he analyzed the relationships between the percentage of black residents in a particular geographic area with a volume of SWAT deployments per 100,000 residents. After controlling for social factors and local crime rates, right? He's looking at social factors and he's looking at crime rates. Think about that. He found that black residents face a more pronounced risk of experiencing militarized policing. However, Momolo suggested caution in generalizing beyond the state of Maryland. So he only looked at Maryland because Maryland is one of the only states to actually keep track of this. Another state is actually Utah, at least from what I could find. And I've been Googling to see what other states actually keep track of their SWAT deployment, and it's been difficult to find. To estimate the effects of police militarization on crime and officer safety, he compared the deployments of SWAT teams with a number of other violent crimes and officers who were killed or injured. On average, the results show that creating more SWAT teams and increasing SWAT deployments had little to no benefits in terms of crime reduction or officer safety. Again, he cautions against overgeneralizing this finding as it may not apply to each agency. So we're talking about keeping officers safe. We're talking about reduction in crime, and it's just not having that effect, at least according to the study that Momolo did about Maryland. Here's what Momolo did in researching and trying to gather how citizens felt about this militarization of the police. Momolo conducted two survey experiments to assess the effect on the public's perception of police when they see militarized police in news reports. First, respondents read a mock news article about a police chief seeking a budget increase, accompanied by a randomly assigned image with an either militarized police or traditionally equipped police. Respondents then answered questions related to perceived crime levels, support for police spending, and confidence in police. The results show that citizens react negatively to the appearance of militarized police units in news reports and become less willing to fund police or want police patrols in their neighborhood. So he did this experiment in which officers were clad in regular uniforms versus this militarized police look, wanted support from the community through increases in budgetary expenses, things like that. And not only did they not want to give them, the citizens not want to give the officers the money, but they didn't even want them in their neighborhoods. So think about that. There's a report from the ACLU, very good report so far that I'm reading. It's called War Comes Home, The Excessive Militarization of American Policing. It's from June of 2014, another one that's fairly dated. But I got to read to you a number of these items on here. Here's a story. I'm just going to say her first name because I know I'm going to butcher her last name. Her last name is Fenish Savana or something like that. Alicia, I'll spell the last name, Phonesavanh. So however that's pronounced. I'll just read to you a little bit about the story. So just close your eyes and just listen to the story. It took several hours before Alicia and Bouncombe, the baby's parents, were able to see their son. The 19-month-old had been taken to an intensive burn unit and placed in a medically induced coma. When the flashbang grenade exploded, it blew a hole into 19-month-old Bobo's face and chest. The chest wound was so deep it exposed his ribs. The blast covered Bobo's body in third-degree burns. At the time of this report's publication, 3 weeks after the raid, it was still unclear whether baby Bobo would live. Bouncombe spent his Father's Day in the hospital with his son. The SWAT team was executing a no-knock warrant to search for someone who did not live in the home that was raided, Bouncombe's nephew, who was suspected of making a $50 drug sale. So for $50, these officers threw a grenade into this baby's room, exploded, and tore a hole in his kid's chest for a $50 drug raid. After breaking down the door, throwing my husband to the ground and screaming at my children, the officers armed with M16s filed through the house like they were playing war, said Alicia. The officers did not find any guns or drugs in the house, and no arrests were made. Bouncombe's nephew was eventually arrested without incident at another location, holding a small amount of drugs on him. Terrible, terrible story. Couple of quotes from Alicia. This is about race. You don't see SWAT teams going into a white-collar community throwing grenades into their homes. My three little girls are terrified of the police now. They don't want to go to sleep because they're afraid the cops will kill them or their family. From the report, War Comes Home, it gives an excuse as far as why these officers are doing what they're doing, as far as the excuse for why this militarization is going on. And one of them, once again, is for this preparation for drugs and for the possibility of terrorist attacks. The piece summarizes a presentation given at a conference of the International Association of Law Enforcement Firearm Instructors and warns that preparations for attacks in American schools that will bring rivers of blood and staggering body counts are well underway in Islamic terrorist camps. It further states that police agencies aren't used to this. We deal with acts of a criminal nature. This is an act of war. But because of our laws, we can't depend on the military to help us. The U.S. is the one nation in the world where the military is not the first line of defense against domestic terrorist attack. By law, you, the police officer, are our Delta Force. It provides the 4Ds for thwarting terrorist plans to massacre our school children, and concludes with an admonition to build the right mindset in your troops. This is what was going on a police instructor's seminar. I talked about the warrior mentality in a previous episode. This is the warrior mentality on steroids. This is a problem when you're training officers to be the Delta Force. And we know that these Islamic terrorist camps are not the biggest threat to our children. It's our own homegrown domestic terrorists that are biggest threat, but I'm not going to go down that road again. Talked about that in a couple of previous episodes, so check those out. At 6 a.m. in the morning, a SWAT officer shot a dog during a no-knock raid in search of a home. The suspect was a single black male who was suspected of selling marijuana in his home, solely on the basis of information provided by a confidential informant, which is often unreliable. The SWAT team believed that the man possessed firearms. No information was provided about what kind or how many firearms the man was believed to possess. The team deployed a distracting device and broke down the front door, causing damage and surprise. They found two unarmed men inside, along with a dog that bit one of the officers. Obviously, the dog's protecting his home, right? The officer was carrying a shotgun against the team's own policy. Crazy. Using the shotgun, the officer shot the dog. 70% of the people impacted by the Burlington SWAT deployment the ACL studied were black. Continuing from the report, generally speaking, the Fourth Amendment in the U.S. Constitution prohibits the police from entering a person's home without a warrant. Historically, if the police had a warrant to search a person's home, they were required to, by law, to knock on the door, announce their presence, and wait for someone to answer. When a person answered the door, the police were required to show the warrant, and they were entitled to demand entry to conduct a search. Although the knock and announce rule still exists today, police executing a search warrant need not follow the rule if they have a reasonable suspicion that the circumstances present a threat of physical violence or that evidence would be destroyed if advance notice were given. So this reason is going towards just about every single drug raid, drug warrant search, right? Because people can flush things down a toilet. So if you're looking for a little bit of drugs, you kick the door in because he might flush those drugs down the toilet. Or because there's often a correlation that has been established between the presence of guns, the presence of drugs. So if someone has drugs in the house, then that is a correlation between that they will also have weapons in the house. So therefore, every single drug raid, if you're searching for drugs, then you get to kick the door in because more than likely they're going to have guns in the house. This is the logic. And next thing you know, you're getting sound grenades, distraction grenades thrown through your door, and you have a 19-month-old baby's ribs being exposed. In New Hampshire, three police departments, Concord, Keene, and Manchester's, each use DHS grants to fund the purchase of an armored Bearcat. The amount of the grants was $215,000 to $286,000. Justifications offered for these grants included prevention, protection, response, and recovery activities pertaining to weapons of mass destructions and the threat of terrorism. Seriously? Here's a quote from the Keene, New Hampshire City Council member. Our application talked about the danger of domestic terrorism, but that's just something you put in the grant application to get money. What red-blooded American cop isn't going to be excited about getting a toy like this? This is what it's come down to. During my conversation that you'll hear with former Chief Dave Cooper, I talked about this militarization and how we could change it. And he said, listen, this is just a lot of toys. Essentially, what he said is this is a lot of toys that people want to play with, and they don't want to give up their toys. So here's a councilwoman confirming what the chief is saying, that this is a lot of toys and people want to use and play with their toys. It's sad, and we as a public will face the brunt of this. One of the biggest problems with the militarization in this 1033 program is that there has not been any type of overwatch, right? Remember what the mayor said, there needs to be some type of overwatch. So the government who gives this excess of weapons doesn't require any type of statistical data and what they've done with the weapon, how effective it was, and whether it should be an ongoing process. So the government isn't going to doing that. Many states besides Utah and Maryland, there may be others, I'm not aware of that, but Utah and Maryland definitely are keeping track of the amount of raids that are going on within their communities. Here's what was reported back. Once again, this report is 2014. The records that were produced revealed an extremely troubling trend. The data collecting and reporting in the context of SWAT was at best sporadic and at worst virtually non-existent. Not a single law enforcement agency in this investigation provided records containing all of the information that the ACL believes necessary to undertake a thorough examination of police militarization. Right? So whatever the ACLU was looking for, these people just didn't have it. As I mentioned before, there's a lack of federal oversight. They're not finding out what they're doing with the equipment, how effective is the equipment, which would obviously determine whether they should continue to need that particular type of equipment. So let me read to you again from the CharlesCokeInstitute.org. Proponents of police militarization typically argue that the rise of gangs and cartels has resulted in the use of more sophisticated and deadly weapons by criminals, necessitating more heavily armed officers. While research clearly shows that gang membership activity have both increased, the evidence does not support the assertion that more dangerous weapons are being used during criminal activity. Almost 75% of homicides that occurred in 2016 involved either a handgun or a non-firearm weapon other than explosives. The FBI's Uniform Crime Reporting Program shows that the number of homicides committed with a firearm between 1994 and 2016 decreased by more than 32%. The number of robberies and aggravated assaults involving a firearm declined by more than 40% over that same time period. Assault weapons or semi-automatic weapons with military-style features are used only in a few crimes. One study from 2017 found that they account for as little as 2% of the guns used in a crime. While we all want our law enforcement officers to come home safely each night, it is not the case that those committing crimes are using more dangerous weapons during the commission of those acts. So finally, let me just end this off with what it's tied to. This whole militarization of the police is tied to the war on drugs. It's tied to asset forfeiture, policing for profit. I'll get into that in another episode, but asset forfeiture is basically when officers can come and take your property, your drugs, your money, your car, your house, because it's a revenue or because they believe that it's proceeds from illegal activity. Civil asset forfeiture is a big problem in some states because officers are pulling people over, determining that if you are a nurse or a waitress or something like that, and you have $10,000 on you, then you must have gotten it illegally. And therefore, they're seizing the money, and you have to prove somehow that you legally got the money, which, of course, you have to take time off from work, hire a lawyer, and this is becoming a problem. So we'll talk about that in another episode, asset forfeiture. So this militarization of the police is tied to the war on drugs. It's tied to asset forfeiture, right? I mentioned the Ohio article that talked about police there had seized $300,000 and then bought a Bearcat. It's just a circle and cycle of police mistrust and misconduct. Well, not, I won't say misconduct, but just simple police mistrust. And the military industrial complex. We have this overabundance of weapons and armament that we either aren't using, we haven't sold to our allies, and it's just sitting in warehouses. And rather than do that, they say, hey, look, there's a war on drugs. What can the police use to combat the war on drugs? Well, let's give them some bayonets, and let's give them some rocket launchers and Bearcats that can resist mines and things like that. Now, listen, don't get me wrong. I don't want officers getting hurt. The research is showing that it's not declined the assaults on officers or the injuries to officers. It's not helping with deterrence of crime. The only thing that this militarization is doing that we can see is there's a negative correlation. The more militarization that's going on, it's not keeping people safe, it's not keeping officers safe, and it's not affecting crime. Where the attitude is and what people are doing is they're realizing that they don't want this type of militarization in their communities. Largely race-based, I think, as I proved. And so, and even as the report that I read from you, Alicia, she's stating it from her own mouth that you won't see them going to the country clubs doing this kind of activities. I hope you guys learned something today. Just talking a little bit about the militarization of police, why it's a bad idea. Read through a few of those reports. You'll understand what I'm saying. You will understand what the point is. What can you do? Let me just end this off with what can we do? We can continue fighting against it. We have to continue to write to our mayors, write to our legislatures, Congress members, council persons, those who are in authority, whether it's city, county, state, whatever, write to them, let them know that you don't want this type of activity going on. You don't want them policing in your neighborhoods. It's overwhelmingly not supported. We have to do it in order to build positive relationships. And clearly militarization is not building positive relationships. Anytime the citizens see these officers, they have distrust. They just don't want these people in their communities. They don't want their police officers behaving this way and dressing this way, and in their mind, terrorizing their neighborhood. We can also ask our leaders, our city leaders, state leaders, whatever, to make sure that they have some type of statistical analysis of when and where are these SWAT teams are being used. And they should not be used. SWAT teams should not be used driving up in residential neighborhoods with Bearcats, kicking in doors for $50 drug sales. This is just ridiculous. So write to them and let them know that. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. Hit me up in the email, HunterPoliceConsulting@gmail.com. My website is HunterPoliceTraining.com. CPTL Hunter is Twitter, Captain L Hunter, CPTL Hunter, Instagram, LMH Police Training and Consulting on Facebook, LMH Police Training and Consulting on Facebook. Let me know what I'm doing right. Let me know what I'm doing wrong. Until next time, much love and peace. Take care.